This is an interview with Dr. Neil Humphrey, president of the University of Alaska, approximately 10:30 on the 29th of December 1977. Dr. Humphrey, maybe to go back over the situation, we have what has come out in the papers and your own coming up to the situation, perhaps it would be good if you could give us your initial perspective in terms of what you saw in terms of the job here and the problems or opportunities, and then reviewing in terms of what you know now in contrast to, say, early August or early October, what your perception is now and what were the things that led you to the decision to resign your position.
Things I perceived concerning the University of Alaska before accepting the position was that it was a very challenging situation from the standpoint that it was a statewide system attempting to offer services throughout the state, broad scope of programs, had a strong research component, had gone through, I thought, the trauma of an upheaval of financial difficulties that were related to a cash flow problem. There were assurances that it was a cash flow problem that had been substantially alleviated, and that now the problem was to put it back together, give it a good management base, and get on with the job of higher education. My basic misperception was that the trauma had just started. I came late September, and at that time the audit for FY76 just then became available, and that audit revealed that there was $1,002,000 deficit from FY76, which alerted me immediately, of course, the fact that we had a problem beyond just a cash flow problem financially. Animosity towards the university by the legislature and individual legislators was immediately identified. When I came, the appropriation for statewide administration, the only appropriation, was the president's salary and a secretary. The other appropriation had been impounded by legislative budget and audit, was to be released when they said so. So the university had actually been operating July, August, and part of September, without an appropriation for statewide administration. We were expected to go to legislative budget audit to get this money released and to discuss with them their invitation to also request a supplemental appropriation of some $2.7 million for general programs and $1 million for statewide administration. We asked for a delay. We just could not get the material information together so fast. I came the 23rd or 24th of September, and then they wanted the meeting immediately. They agreed to a 2 or 3 day delay. So we met with them October 5th, and in essence, they handed me my head. Their attitude was that you may be new, but you're the president, you epitomize the university, and the university has been wrong, and we're going to go from that premise. And they wouldn't release the money. Their hostility was overwhelming. And finally, it was agreed that we would meet again October 19th with them. That meeting on October 19th went equally poorly as far as the public part of it was concerned. Finally, Representative or Senator Ferguson from Kotzebue called an executive session, and Ashok Dhingra and Vice President Brewer and I were invited into that executive session. And then we started to make some progress once these legislators were not speaking to their constituents and to the press. And there was a better understanding at that point, but still very specific disagreements. The university had gone from 6 appropriation lines in 1977 to 67 appropriation lines in FY 78. They had gone from appropriation of general fund monies only to a system of reappropriation of all restricted receipts and federal grants and contracts. The legislature had recognized a serious problem at the university, but had so overreacted to it that management of the university was extremely difficult. If it serves your purpose then to try and take that to its conclusion, that as we continued to work with this, and we had worked very hard, we accelerated the closing of FY77's books to understand exactly what the problem was. And when that was identified, then we actually, as of June 30th, 1977, had a deficit in excess of $6 million, plus other very serious financial problems, such as a $13 million accounts receivable, much of which is soft. I came to the conclusion, after a great deal of soul searching, that considering what the legislature's reaction had already been, that with this new problem of an actual deficit and other serious problems that were identified, hard fact, that the legislature was just not willing to work with the university from the standpoint of resolving the problem. Their intent was to control university in such a way from, I assume, good motives of keeping it from having further problems, but without recognizing that the objective was to correct the problem and to continue, as I say, the business of higher education. So I believe that I was no longer willing, I concluded that I was no longer willing to be responsible for what I considered a highly politicized institution, and that it was in my best interest, and I hoped eventually for the university's best interest, that I announce that and resign.
The animosity, I get the sense from what I think you're saying, is that the legislature or LBA was unwilling to give you the prerogative you really felt necessary as a president to deal with the university's financial situation and to work with them, rather than having them come in and do parts of your job or the responsibility for the administration here.
It isn't that they were unwilling to give the president the prerogative, but to give the university. I think a significant problem of this university has been too much centralization of authority in the presidency. The board has given too much authority to the president, and the president hasn't shared that authority adequately with chancellors and the faculty. One of the things I attempted to do during my short stay here was to get that diffused, to make sure that the chancellor's positions were strengthened, and that faculty were adequately consulted on matters. And I really believe that any objective review of that would prove that I was moving in the right direction and rather rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's unfortunate the over-centralization of authority in the presidency. So my argument with the legislature is not the president's prerogative, but the university's.
That they're unwilling to assist the university in becoming responsible for its own physical affairs and working this problem through in a partnership way rather than trying to intrude as perhaps a parent would on a child who is gone financially awry, or a teenage son. Or
well, the university is obviously wrong in having created a deficit in many states. A deficit would result in indictment of the responsible executive officers for malfeasance. Had I been responsible for that situation in the state from which I came, Nevada, I would have expected to be indicted for malfeasance. What's going to happen here, I don't know. It's something that, as a financial and educational administrator for many years, I consider an extremely serious problem. Legislators then look at it in a similar way, but they come to what I believe is a totally erroneous conclusion of how it's corrected. It isn't corrected by continuing to beat the university over the head about it. You have to have competent people administering the university, and then a good audit procedure to make sure that the legislative oversight responsibilities are carried out. But the legislature is attempting to administer the university at this point.
Is your perception that it's primarily the work of a few ambitious legislators, or?
I really don't know.
Okay.
I really don't know. I think it's been considerably compounded, the problem has been considerably compounded by Dave Scott. Dave Scott was the budget director for this institution. He was, my understanding is, and he was asked to head up the negotiating team for the college, community college contract negotiation. In doing so, he apparently tangled with interim president Ferguson in such a way that Dr. Ferguson fired him. Scott's sense of outrage about that situation is total, and he reflects that then in his dealings with the university. We found ourselves in a situation where we were working desperately hard to get things straightened out, and we believed ourselves to be harassed by Scott in his demands upon us. I knew there had been a lot of demands. I was surprised that when I resigned that he released his letters, memos to the university, and there had been 40 separate pieces of correspondence of where he was making demands upon us, plus numerous phone calls, etc. The information that he was asking or demanding of us in itself was reasonable. Now, they were things that we should know about the university, but we believed that we were being caused to chase our tail because we would stop to try and satisfy his demand, spend a lot of time doing that we should have been doing something else, and then realize that the question was rhetorical, that we didn't know the answer, but he already knew that we didn't know the answer when he asked the question, or he knew the answer to the question before he asked it. And it was a demoralizing experience because he was doing this with the authority of legislative budget nodded behind him.
Do you feel that, is your perception that they did not, I want to say control, but work with him, or maybe control is good adjective to word, or good?
I don't think that the legislative budget audit committee really understood what he was doing. That despite some attempts by our regents to identify this to LBA members, they didn't really understand. As I say, that questions that he wanted answered, we should know about the university. And it was unfortunate that we didn't know the major management problem of this university that I found was that the database was almost non-existent, and the accounting structure and system was so very poor that you couldn't answer quite. You'd get into a problem of a management decision, and you would be able to make the decision if you had the proper information. You'd call for the information that wasn't available. We were in a truly ridiculous situation of not even knowing how many students we had this fall. We had so many problems with that we finally, on October 31st, I called a halt to everything and had everybody hand count the fall registration. That resulted in a duplicated headcount enrollment in excess of 39,000, but a full-time equated student enrollment of about 9,000. Which indicates, of course, a major problem in this university, the dependence on part-time students, and the fact that those 9,000 FTEs are spread over 13 administrative units. The fact that students are registered at the University of Alaska Anchorage and taking all their classes at Anchorage Community College. But the whole database problem has got to be resolved before anybody can manage this university. After we completed our hand count and submitted that as a part of our budget documentation, legislative budget audited it and refused to accept its validity. They're going to use a different set of figures that they believe more nearly correct. The accounting system is behind always. People are dependent here upon what are called soft ledgers. Everybody's keeping their own set of books, in other words. And only through a lot of hard work on the part of many people in the accounting office has that been improved. They've really given it a lot of hard work, a lot of effective work this fall, but it's still totally deficient. It is not a good accounting system. I think that the people involved deserve a lot of credit, but unfortunately it isn't enough, and that's the situation we found ourselves in all fall. Everybody was making progress, but it wasn't enough.
Your discussion of the accounting system, I guess my perception of the switchover in terms of computer center operations and programs and software was that the university had a faltering horse upon which it was riding, and it leaped full gallop to another horse which had never tried. And it seemed to be at least a 6 month to an 18 month time when the university did not have any good financial information, and people who responsible in terms of fiscal management found it impossible without soft ledgers to get their programs to even begin to account for their programs. Then, at least at the end of June, there seemed to be funds that were uncovered within the last few days, and these were expended. Is this common practice of year-end? I know the university has done it for years, but is this a one common, too healthy practice to be involved with when spending year-end monies within, say, the last two or three business days of the year? Or, in fact, holding purchasers because there's such a large multitude of purchasers that it can't be processed on a timely basis?
Christian, your basic premise has to be understood that the accounting system was... they had attempted to change accounting systems, and it had not worked, so they had withdrawn, and they were still in a very confused state. So the interim president and the people working with him assumed that they had money that they did indeed not have. They, considering their financial situation, were totally unjustified in quote, spending year-end money. They should have known that their data was suspect and that they shouldn't have tried to accomplish this. Even if your accounting system is right up to snuff and everything working correctly, in my opinion, what they did was not justified, would not have been justified, because they were changing budget credits without the authority of the Board of Regents. It was done by administrators. They do not have that authority. Budget credits are established by the Board of Regents. They can be changed only by the Board of Regents. So their administrative judgment was poor in the first place. They should have known they couldn't depend on their records. All their experience had indicated that, but even if they could have depended upon it, they were wrong legally because they were changing budget credits.
Did you see or perceive a problem with some people who were involved with financial management also making program decisions? Or I guess my perception was that the people who were closest to the finances were also making decisions where they were using money for their personal for their programs, and that money or the diversion of that money was never reviewed by people outside the financial area. Perhaps a fountain conception of those who was closest to the fountain drank freely, and those who were further out were not.
I don't have enough information to respond to that question, but let me use it to as a takeoff point on another part of the administrative problem. It's extremely important in managing a university that you have a sequence of planning, budgeting, and reporting. And it is a sequence. One is dependent upon the other. The process that I found here was budgeting as an accounting process rather than as a part of the planning process. If a budget is not a financial interpretation of a plan, then all it is an expedient to establish a budget credit so that you can pay some bills. The so-called academic plan of 1975 is not a plan. It's a narrative on its way toward being a plan. And it's a pretty good one from that standpoint. It's a pretty good narrative about what this university seemed to be about in 1975. And with the right amount of faculty involvement, it could have become a typical academic plan, a set of long-range goals, which are generic in nature, with objectives, then subsets of those goals, where you could establish some time frames for the accomplishment of your goals, and then a budget that would define activities to accomplish the objectives. The reporting system then is not only accounting, but your whole institutional studies area of being able to report your activities to implement the objectives of the institution. The failure of the state legislature to understand that that process has to flow for an educational institution, that it is not run the same way as a business, that it is a faculty-oriented operation. They then insist on the university using the executive budget format with all of its problems and its problems in time frame. And we tried to convince the executive branch that that wouldn't work for us. They seemed sympathetic to the problem but felt constrained by the law. And so, although I think that the Ron Lind and Barbara Thomas and the Governor's Budget Office gave us every cooperation they could within their perception of the law, it, our inability to change that budget sequence is a part of the failure here. We have a budget that is merely an accounting roll-up for next year and is not a financial interpretation of a plan that has been broadly based.
You briefly discussed the difference between the accounting planning needs of the university and that of the executive and legislature. Is it your perception that the legislature and the executive are dealing primarily with, in their accounting experience, with either profit institutions or the state as a nonprofit institution rather than perhaps the differing requirements of the university as a nonprofit institution?
They're dealing with the executive agency concepts. Budgeting concepts that they're attempting to use for the university would work fine in the health department or Department of Motor Vehicles or whatever, but they're not applicable to an institution of higher education.
How would you characterize the differences?
The the governor assigns, first of all, the formats, you know, the forms used are for executive agencies, and they're very time consuming to do, and yet are not leading the university to the information it needs, which student centered activities for instruction plus research or public service activities. The whole concept of building a budget upon an adopted plan is not working from the standpoint of just the time available. Remember that, again, when I came in late September, it was not late September 1977, 2.5 months into the FY78 year, there was not an FY78 budget yet adopted. We had to do that within a period of less than a month, and then immediately start on the problem of adopting an FY79 budget within a totally unrealistic time frame. We, with the staff available, we could, with maximum cooperation of faculty and campus administrators, put together a reasonable financial interpretation of a plan in 6 or 8 months. But to attempt to do it in 6 weeks was an impossibility. I'd like to mention a serious mistake that I believe I made in this fall, and it's a curious one, but I got off the plane on the 23rd or 24th of September and hit the ground running, and the central administrative staff and the chancellors and everybody else were supportive, and everybody's attitude is, let's go to work and really whip this. And we started to work, and we worked day in, day out. I, myself, took 2 half-Sundays off prior to Thanksgiving. Other people were working as much or more, and the battle fatigue set in to the point that the mistake was trying too hard and working too long. We would have, you know, in retrospect, I wish that I had said, let's all work a 48-hour week and nobody come near this place on Sundays, and, you know, I really think we would have been better off. It's an odd mistake to have made to try too hard, but I think that's what happened.
That's an interesting observation. I guess I'm impressed with the the background that you brought to the university in terms of fiscal management, being on, I guess, perhaps three sides of the fence with the university, with the state legislature, and also with the taxpayers group. If you, perhaps it's a hypothetical question, if you were in the state administration and the agency that you had been responsible for monitoring terminated somebody in their budget department, would you feel it unwise or unacceptable or appropriate to hire that individual to interface with that agency later on down the road?
No, I don't think it's appropriate. In Mr. Scott's case, if he had left the university of his own volition and looked for another job, well, then it would be appropriate to for the legislature to hire him as the analyst that was going to review the university's work, if his knowledge of the university could be utilized in the right way. But he was dismissed, had threatened suit against the university, was a bitter man, and even if he tries to be objective and ethical, his passion is bound to get the best of him in a situation like this, and I think it was a very unwise thing for the legislature to hire him.
Are there other things that you would characterize by the budgeting process or the financial process at the university that perhaps would not be understood by the state legislature or the public in terms of the need for reserves, the different kinds of problems dealing with restricted accounts in research areas where people are coming and going and funds are in and out?
With two biggest areas, I think I've mentioned that the university went from 6 appropriation lines to 67. And in order to move money among those lines, you have to go through the Board of Regents and then have the governor's approval and the legislature's approval to move money. My analysis of the University of Alaska is that 23 appropriation lines would be the correct number. That, and I've detailed this to the Board of Regents and to the governor, as the right number of separate appropriation lines for the sharing of responsibility of funding and management. But there were 67, and a very complicated process then from movement. The other extremely important thing is in the state's insistence on reappropriation of restricted receipts. This has been so misunderstood by so many people in the university that when those assumptions about restricted receipts were reappropriated, they believed them to be an appropriation and a budget credit established. And if, for example, $100,000 had been estimated as a receipt in a restricted account, they believed that they had that $100,000, even though $70,000 might be the true figure. And so there was mass confusion about what was actually occurring.
You mentioned briefly the other problem of $13 million accounts receivable, much of which was soft. What would you estimate in a good business would be a percentage of uncollectibles in a accounts receivable, and perhaps what would you estimate the uncollectibles to be in this particular instance? Or what is your perception or perhaps fear?
Well, a number of things have gone wrong here with the whole accounts receivable concept. Has to be understood that this university has an exceptionally high dependence upon federal grants and contracts in its research area. Total area in excess of $40 million for research grants and contracts, $8 million of which is appropriated in round figures. The balance from federal grants and contracts and some state monies that are contracts, not appropriations. The federal grants are on letters of credit where you get the money and then do the work. But most of it are contracts where you must do the work and then bill the federal government to get the money. And many of these were negotiated in such a way that they were quarterly billings instead of monthly billings. That was a mistake. They should have always been monthly billings. Then when the accounting system broke down, people were afraid or to bill or felt they didn't have the information to bill from soft ledgers, and so they just not bill for months on end, and the monies were still expended, the accounts receivable grew, and yet the federal government wasn't being billed. We spent considerable effort trying to correct that problem, bringing the quarterly billings down to monthly billings, getting people to bill off their soft ledgers if necessary, with corrected billings at the end of a project, whatever. This was being improved, but it has a long way to go. To have an accounts receivable of $13 million is totally unacceptable. You shouldn't really be more than 1 month out of pocket in a situation like this. The legislature, when they realized the cash flow problem, instead of helping it, hurt it. They withdrew their revolving fund. There was $1,350,000 that had been given to the university by the legislature as a revolving fund, and they withdrew it. The university still owes that money back to the legislature, by the way. It hasn't been repaid yet. It fortunately is set up as a liability on the balance sheet, but so would not add to the deficit. Those federal accounts receivable are generally considered to be valid and good, but they're always subject to audit. And my experience with federal contracts is that upon audit, a certain percentage of them can be expected to result in problems where you must repay a part of the money that you've already received, or you won't get all that you billed. That will just have to be worked out over a period of time. Also, a part of these accounts receivable, and I can't give you an exact figure because the accounting is still working on this, but a part of them are student accounts receivable. They've been allowing students to register, pay a part of their registration, and then pay a balance about midterm. The way this would normally work, if you allow this, is that when the student then doesn't make that second payment, he is deregistered and the accounts receivable wiped off. Here, if a student didn't make the payment, he was or she were pursued but allowed to continue their registration, and the accounts receivable stayed on the books. Once you have a student accounts receivable for a prior semester, it is generally considered uncollectible. And so to the extent that the accounts receivable is from students, then it is totally soft. It's going to increase the deficit of the university.
One of the problems over the last few years seemed to have been the University Computer Center. I know that you had a colleague who was familiar in that area come up and study the situation, make some recommendations. Do you want to discuss that at all, or what you see the university's role in doing it? Is it, do you see it has a responsibility to run its own center, or is this the agency concept a particularly attractive one, or?
University of Alaska entered into a contract with SCT for SCT to provide computing services. Before I even came, I asked for a copy of that contract and started to try and analyze it. It's a contract in excess of 100 pages. It's a mishmash of extraneous material. The responsibilities of the parties to the contract are very difficult to decipher. Earl Brewer, the vice president for finance, has spent considerable time working with the contract finds it equally impossible. The basic part of the contract is that